Good afternoon, I'm Kathy Lewis. Mourners are lining up in Havana to pay their respects to Cuba's revolutionary-turned-national leader, Fidel Castro, who died Friday. In response, President-elect Trump is threatening to scrap the 2014 deal that reopened relationships between the U.S. and Cuba. We'll talk with a scholar at the College of William & Mary about the complexity of Fidel and what happens now. We'll also get a checkup on the health of the Chesapeake Bay and some changes in the catch limits for that popular little fish known as the menhaden. Catch limits are going up, but not everybody's enthusiastic about it. Let's talk about it right after this news from NPR. Minutes past the hour. We're glad you're with us today. Hope you had a great Thanksgiving holiday. We are back in the saddle with a great week of shows for you. And we're very, very happy to have you with us today. We're going to talk today in the second half of our program about the death of Fidel Castro and what is next in terms of Cuban and U.S. relationships. And maybe you are somebody who has been to Cuba recently. The Chrysler Museum just took a big trip to Cuba. Maybe you are one of those folks who was fortunate enough to go on that expedition. Maybe you have been to Cuba as these relationships have thawed between the U.S. and Cuba, that as a result of an agreement in 2014, President-elect Trump now says that if a better deal can't be had, he will plan to scrap the one that is in place. And so there are lots of implications of this, about which we will discuss with Dr. Anne-Marie Stock, who actually met Fidel Castro. She's a professor of Hispanic Studies and Film and Media Studies at the College of William & Mary, and she's also a William & Mary's Libraries faculty scholar. So we'll talk with her in the second half of the program at 8 minutes past the hour. Right now, though, we're talking about the state of the Chesapeake Bay, a couple of important developments therein. And, of course, the Chesapeake Bay is so critically important to our region and to the Commonwealth. We're glad to have back with us in the studio today Chris Moore, who's the Hampton Roads senior scientist for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. He's looking at a lot of policy issues and water quality and fisheries restoration efforts. Chris, good to have you with us
today. Thank you for having me again. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. So I know that you have really been looking at a number of issues from a scientific perspective. And every time we see you, we want to check on the health of the blue crabs. So bring us up to speed on that.
So blue crabs, it's good news to report there. In fact, the last 2 years, we've really had good news. The population overall is up, which is a good thing. In addition, the population of adult females, those are the spawning stock in the population, is up as well. And so that's the thing that we really want to look at and shows us how well the population overall is doing. And that number is up as well. So a good news situation there. Harvests have been really good throughout the Chesapeake Bay this year, which is good for all of us. I think the only downside has been we harvested so much that the prices for the watermen who catch those has not been as great. Yeah. And obviously, we want to see both a healthy ecology out there with the blue crabs, but we also want to see a healthy economic environment for
that's
the people
such
who harvest
a,
those.
That's such a linked scenario, isn't it?
Because it is.
For so many of the fish.
It is. And unfortunately, with blue crabs, what's actually happened is we've lost, as the population dwindled, we lost what we call the picking infrastructure, which would pick the blue crabs and get that meat to market. And so therefore, we need to figure out ways to make sure our watermen can remain viable in the future, while we also have a healthier bay and a healthier blue crab population.
Yeah, that's
as well.
A great point. That's a great point. So many of those jobs that took place at the water's edge aren't there anymore, least the basis of them isn't there anymore. I can remember years and years ago watching folks do that. It was a very robust industry. Not
that
as
is,
much anymore.
Yeah. You know, there was similar concerns with our oyster industry that we would lose that. And fortunately, we didn't lose the infrastructure there, although it's much smaller than it used to be. But our oyster fishery has been doing great the last couple of years. We've really seen a resurgence there. And so it's another success story.
That's great.
Right now that we can talk about.
And one of the other things we should note is that there have been some new announcements with regard to the menhaden population, and that, in fact, will be the subject of the upcoming Blue Planet Forum, which is a Chesapeake Bay Foundation presentation. They're going to be talking about events related to menhaden on December 6th, Menhaden, not Menhaven. That's December 6th from 6:30 to 8:30 at that beautiful public meeting room at the Slovert Library. It is free and open to the public. You can learn more at cbf.org/blueplanet. They're going to be talking about Menhaden because very important to Virginia. Virginia is actually the epicenter of the Atlantic Coast Menhaden fishery, and it's responsible for about 85% of the total catch of Menhaden coast-wide. And as you know, if you listen to this program or read the newspapers or any other media sources in the last couple of years, there's been a lot of controversy about Menhaden. We're at 11 minutes past the hour, so there's some new developments in regard to Menhaden, and that will be the topic of conversation at the next Blue Planet Forum. Chris, tell us about Menhaden. Introduce us to this fish for those of us who aren't familiar with it.
Sure. They're the small silvery fish, and when I say small, if you see one over a pound, it's a very big one. It's one that you'll never see on a dining room menu or a restaurant menu. If you do, I always tell people to run away quickly. but it really is, in a scientific terms, it's one of the fish species that basically converts sunlight into energy and food for other species. So they eat microscopic algae, plankton, things like that as they swim through the water. And then they're eaten by a whole host of other things, things you would think, striped bass, bluefish, summer flounder, things like that, but also things like osprey that are obviously so common to the area and that we all enjoy seeing, and things like marine mammals, dolphins and whales and things like that. So they're a of huge importance in the marine food chain, especially in an estuary here like Chesapeake Bay, because they swim in tight schools as they move through the water, and then they become prey for all these other
sure.
different species that are either here part of the year or here throughout the summer.
It's interesting because very much like the blue crab, there's an environmental importance, but there's also an economic importance to Menhaden.
Exactly. It's by far the largest fishery, not only on the East Coast, but obviously here in Virginia there as well. And so Virginia has the one remaining Menhaden reduction facility where basically they catch Menhaden and they take them to be reduced into fish meal and fish oil. And then those products are sold in all sorts of different products. We see omega-3s
sure.
and all. But in addition, we have a very big bait fishery. And there's kind of two components to that. There's a large-scale bait fishery that catches bait with the similar gear as the reduction fishery. And that bait gets sold to New England and all over the coast. And there's what we call kind of small-scale bait, which is pound nets, gill nets, and things like that. And that bait goes to local crabbers, to local sports fishermen who may use it for bait for cobia and other things like that. But Menhaden is intertwined in lots
yeah.
of different ways economically throughout the region here.
It's such a great point. And it was a source of great controversy a couple of years ago because there was a restriction put on the amount of catch that the amount of Menhaden you could catch because the fear was overfishing.
Exactly. The population models that were used at that time showed us that the population was not healthy. And so the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, which manages the fishery coastwide, they imposed a 20% reduction on the amount of Menhaden that we could catch coastwide. And obviously with Virginia holding 85% of that total coastwide catch, we were the one where that reduction in catch
sure.
Was felt the most.
Yeah, again, highly controversial, 14 minutes past the hour, 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. The recent news, though, is that Menhaden catch limit, which had been reduced, has now been increased by about 6.5%, 6.45% to be specific. And there's been a lot of conversation about this, whether this was a good idea, whether it was the right time. And that's what we're going to talk about today as well. 14 minutes past the hour, 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Those questions will also be addressed at the Chesapeake Bay Foundation's Blue Planet Forum. That is coming up on December 6th from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Slover Library. There's an author named Dick Russell who will be there. He's the author of Striper Wars. The former Virginia Marine Resources Commissioner, Jack Travelstead, will be there. Also, former North Carolina Division of Marine Fisheries Director Louis Daniel will be there as well. And Don Lozado, our good colleague from the Virginian Pilot, will be facilitating that conversation. He's very, very knowledgeable about this, so that will be a good thing indeed. And again, if you're interested in attending, you can go to cbf.org/blueplanet for more information. We're going to be talking with John Bull in a couple of minutes as well. He's the commissioner of the Virginia Marine Resources Commission. And Megan Ware will be joining us. She is the Fisheries Management Plan Coordinator for Atlantic Menhaden at the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. Joseph Gordon is with us as well now. He's the manager for the Pew Charitable Trust's U.S. Oceans Northeast. Joseph Gordon, thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for allowing us to participate.
You bet. So this increase, we've sort of laid out the story of Menhaden here, threat of overfishing, limits on the amount of Menhaden that could be taken in. Now there is this increase of 6.45% in that limit. What does your research tell you from Pew about that increase and whether it's a good idea?
Okay. Well, I think just going back quickly to what was discussed before, before December 2012, there was no coastwide limit at all. And so the commission really transitioned, not just because of overfishing, but in general to protect the species and ensure science-based management. And last year, they committed to a bigger picture ecosystem approach. And that was reaffirmed again in a most recent meeting when they did an increase. But what the science is not clear about is what any increase, what the impact would be to predators at this time. So we're, you know, it's not Pew science, it's really the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission science. And it's very clear that this population of Menhaden itself is showing significant signs of improvement, and that's great. But what we don't understand is what the most recent increase, which in November was 6.5% to the coastwide total, which means that there will be millions less fish in the ocean. What will that mean for striped bass, weak fish, bluefish, and the other predators along the Atlantic coast would depend on them? So we were disappointed with that increase. We felt like the science did not yet, from a coastwide ecosystem perspective, justify it. But again, we were pleased that the commission continues to move forward with an ecosystem approach that will, we hope in the next year, account for predators in a more sustainable way.
17 minutes past the hour, it's 440-2665. 1-800-940-2240. Wondering if you are engaged in the business of Menhaden or you're engaged in the business of fishing in general, then you know that these fish are incredibly important off the coast of the Commonwealth and indeed up and down the Atlantic seaboard. So we're wondering what your take is on this roughly 6.5% increase in the Menhaden catch limit. 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. This is another scenario where you have the challenge of balancing conservation and business concerns, and it is at that intersection that we all live, right, Chris?
That's right. There, with Menhaden, especially because we have such a large fishery here in Virginia, it's something that there is a great amount of debate about in Virginia, and I think for a long time. We've looked at this as hopefully not necessarily winners and losers, but hopefully we end up in a situation where we have a healthier population overall, and that's good for the ecosystem and good for the economy as well. And that's what we really want to do with all the bay resources that we manage. The same thing with blue crab fishery. We've seen that start to rebound. Same thing with oysters. You know, there were some tough times with that, but as we've seen the resource rebound, we've seen the fact that the economic importance and the economic power behind those fisheries has rebounded as well.
We have talked in recent years with the folks at Elizabeth River Project and others, and yourselves included, of course, about ways we, generally speaking, improve the health of the water. Is that the right strategy for all of us who are not engaged in fishing to sort of participate in this, or is there something else that average folks can do?
I think you hit the nail on the head. You know, in taking efforts to improve water quality for the average citizen is probably the most important thing that they can do. It's going to help things like oysters because we're going to have better oyster habitat out there. It's going to help things like Menhaden because we're going to have less areas of low dissolved oxygen, so they'll be able to swim in more areas of the bay. It's going to help things like blue crabs because as water clarity gets better, we're going to have more seagrasses, which will allow more small blue crabs to hide and forage and stay away from predators. So that really is improving water quality, we feel, is the key to improving the fisheries resource and the habitat resource as well.
20 minutes past the hour, and we want to let you know that this Menhaden Matter conversation is coming up Tuesday, December 6th from 6:30 to 8:30 at the Slover Library. Tom's on the line from Cape Charles. Hi, Tom. You're on the air.
Yes. My question is regarding, I guess, the I live over on the Eastern Shore, and I catch a few menhaden, you know, in a net, you know, trying to catch, you know, some eating fish, I'll put it that way. And I've noticed a lot of the menhaden, and it is a lot of them, too. They sure do seem like they're on the increase. But I noticed they, I wouldn't call them lesions, but they, a lot of them seem to have little kind of little pinprick sort of, you know, something going on the, you know, on the side, on their sides. And I was just curious if, you know, what that might be or what's causing it, or has that even, you know, been noticed by.
It's a great question, Tom. Thank you for the call.
So without seeing the fish, obviously, it's hard to tell exactly what it is. But that is one of the concerns with poor water quality in the bay is the fact that it creates an environment that's not as healthy for fisheries resources, whether it's menhaden, whether it's things in the upper part of the watershed like white perch or even getting beyond that, smallmouth bass, that when we don't have a healthy ecosystem, it leads to fish resources being more susceptible to all sorts of different types of viruses or bacteria or things like that. So not only are we trying to improve the actual quality of the resource, but by making the resource healthier, fish are not going to show some of these signs of stress, which then leads them to become infected with various virus and bacteria and things like that in the future.
Megan Ware is with us, and she's the Fishery Management Plan Coordinator for Atlantic Menhaden at the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission. Megan Ware, thank you for joining us.
Hi, thank you. How are you?
Fine, thanks. Our caller asked, and I know you were able to hear the question because you joined us for just the last couple of minutes here. Our caller spoke about the what appears to be some sort of fish stress, and I want to get an answer from you for his question, whether you've noticed anything like that or what you might be looking for.
Yeah, I would agree. It's kind of hard to tell without seeing a picture or a good description of it. But it's not something that I've been hearing a lot about, so potentially this is something new and we need to be looking at. I work more on the management side, so I work on setting catch limits for menhaden to make sure we provide for both a fishery as well as some of the ecosystem needs that menhaden serves.
As you know, one of the concerns about the increase in the catch limit that was announced in November, and Joseph Gordon expressed this from the Pew Charitable Trust, is the concern that the science doesn't apparently justify it, or the sense is that the science doesn't justify it. So I wonder if you could give us a sense of what was behind the decision to increase those limits.
Sure. So I guess I'll provide just a little bit of background. We first set a limit in 2013 to address some concerns with overfishing, and that limit was a 20% decrease from the 2009 to 2011 average harvest. And since that time, we've increased it slightly twice. And this time, we have a science body that ran some stock projections on what might happen if we increase the catch limit by various amounts. And for each of those, there was a 0% chance of overfishing occurring. And so I think the board took that into consideration and decided to do more of a minimal increase to help out with some of the issues we're seeing in the fishery, but also to consider the ecosystem needs that menhaden do serve.
And when you said help out with some of the issues that you're seeing in the fishery, and we should note that by fishery, this is multiple fisheries up and down the coast, of sort of making it sound like it's just one. What are some of those issues that you're noticing?
Sure. So since we set the catch limits in 2013, we are seeing higher abundances, especially in the species' northern and southern range. So areas like New England are seeing a lot more menhaden than we've seen in previous years. And right now, those states have very small quotas, so they're not able to land lots of fish. And this is leading to some issues where states are having to close their fisheries quite early. In Maine, we had issues with bait or limited amounts of bait. We're seeing fish kills. And so at this point, we're trying to adapt to a growing abundance of a species, which is really a great thing. But how do we balance that in terms of management?
We're at 25 minutes past the hour. Dave's on the line from James City County. Hi, Dave, you're on the air.
Hello, Kathy.
Hi.
It's like Back to the Future. I was in Florida many years ago. I was a teacher and administrator, and I had an interest in a Sternhauer boat, worked on it, made some money, and out of Port Salerno. And they had menhaden fishermen with plane spotters and huge circle nets. And they kept on coming. This was before they put some controls on, snatching every possible fish they could.
Right.
And it had a horrible impact on the Spanish mackerel catches and all the other things that the commercial boys would go out fishing for. In a matter of a couple of years, the fish that would feed on them weren't there anymore. They left.
Yeah. And I'll tell you what you're talking about, Dave, and Chris Moore, correct me if I'm wrong, but this is exactly the kind of scenario that that Dave's describing that was sort of beginning to happen and about which these regulations were promulgated.
Right. That one of the concerns has always been the fact that the fishery, being yes. Virginia has 85% of the total cuttlefish fishery, is centered here in Chesapeake Bay, which is a huge body of water, but pretty small when you think about it along the entire coast. So we take a very large proportion of that catch in a fairly defined area. And so the concerns from a conservation point of view are making sure we have enough fish out there to actually serve the ecosystem needs and be food for other fish. A lot of anglers are concerned the fact that as we take those fish away, the sport fish, as the caller said, go with them. And that was highlighted kind of along the coast of Virginia Beach last summer when there was a lot of fishing in that area. The catches by the charter fleet out of Rudy were down, and there was a lot of concern about the fact that they weren't having the season they had because the bait that attracts the fish
right.
that they want to target weren't there.
We're at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Joseph Gordon, as you look at this issue, these new increased limits are now in place. What is Pew going to be looking at down the road on this? I'm guessing you'll be watching this carefully.
Well, this is actually a really important transition moment, not just for the menhaden fishery and not just for the East Coast, but really setting a standard for the country in terms of how you manage a forage fish, which is a fish that is so important to other species. And the commission has set, it's supposed to complete November of next year, a new management plan that will finally account for the value of this fish for other species and how we set limits. And that's where the debate goes. I mean, we can't look at this species in isolation, and there is certainly science to justify increasing menhaden if it were only on its own. But if you consider that striped bass are in trouble or have been in decline overall coastwide, and if you look at weakfish or bluefish, which have taken a little bit of a dip, you have to look at the overall system. And so the commission will be looking, and there's already a current comment period now, hearings, in fact, in Virginia coming up next week. And then there'll be the final draft amendment and final amendment anticipated next year. And the entire system for managing this fish, which is sometimes called the most important fish in the sea, everywhere from Nova Scotia down to Florida, but in the U.S. managed from Maine to Florida, that the whole system could be different. And so that's, we're very excited about the opportunity there. And we hope that, Dr. Moore said, that the overall resource, the menhaden resource will increase, which will provide more jobs, more seafood, and healthier predator fish for everyone along the Atlantic coast.
Joseph Gordon, I want to thank you for joining us today from the Pew Charitable Trust's U.S. Oceans Northeast sector. Thank you so much for being with us. 28 minutes past the hour. We're at 440-2665. 1-800-940-2240. Those are the numbers where you can join us today. And we're talking with Megan Ware, who is with the Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission, and Chris Moore, who is the senior scientist for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation in Hampton Roads. You can join us, 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. Mark is on the line from Virginia Beach. Hi, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Kathy. How are you?
Hi. Fine, thanks. Go right ahead.
So my question is, during Hurricane Matthew last month, whenever it was, there was a huge sewer line break at the Laskin Road Bridge and dumped an enormous amount of raw sewage in all the tributaries there, I guess, and around the ocean front. And I do quite a bit of fishing out there and have been catching fish lately. I was kind of wondering what the status was, if it was still good to eat or not.
Ah, very interesting question.
So finfish tend to, yes, still tend to be safe to eat. Because of that break, though, the Virginia Department of Shellfish Sanitation, Department of Health, they actually closed a large area in that area down for shellfishing. So we couldn't take oysters, clams, things like that because of that. And as filter feeders, they're the type of animal that will kind of biomagnify that bacteria and would not be safe for consumption. But finfish, fortunately, because they eat other fish, you tend to be okay in that case.
How's that sound, Mark?
Good. We've been catching stripers and trouts out there.
All right. Thank you for the call. It's a great question. 29 minutes before the hour, and we're at 440-2665, 1-800-940-2240. John Bull with us. He's the commissioner of the Virginia Marine Resources Commission. Thanks for being with us, Mr. Bill. Bull, appreciate it very much.
Glad to be with you, Kathy. Good afternoon.
Hi. So we've been talking a bit about menhaden and the slight increase in the catch limits. And I know that you at the VMRC have a public hearing underway, a couple of public comment period coming up on Atlantic menhaden.
Yes, that's right. The Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission did enact a coastwide quota increase, and we're mandated to hold public hearings on this, and we do want to hear from the public on this.
And so people can come, it's December 5th at 6 p.m., at the VMRC office in Newport News. And so that's going to be a great opportunity, particularly for folks in this region. 2600 Washington Avenue in Newport News is the address. It's December 5th at 6 o'clock. That is going to be the time of the scheduled hearings on the Atlantic menhaden document. We're at 29 minutes before the hour. Woodrow's on the line from Matthews County. Hi, Woodrow. You're on the air.
Good morning, Kathy. My concern is that the water quality in the Chesapeake Bay has been improving due to environmental constraints. And our neighboring county, Gloucester, its board of supervisors is currently considering relaxing those restrictions as far as building on waterfront property is concerned. In the Pink Tank River, on the Pink Tank where I live, I noticed for the first time this year that seagrass is growing on the sand flat under front of my residence, and this is something I've never seen before. It's very encouraging, and it's very disturbing to hear that our neighboring county is considering relaxing some of these restrictions that have brought us about.
Well, let's get some comment on that, Woodrow, and I thank you for the call. Chris?
Sure. So, as I think you're aware, and a lot of your callers are aware, that Virginia has basically a buffer act that puts forth a 100-foot buffer around our waterways and undeveloped areas. And this is part of what it's the neighboring county there is talking about relaxing. There is some local control over that. And so there's been a lot of discussion in the newspaper and things about that issue. And exactly as you said, we're seeing water quality increase throughout the Chesapeake Bay area. We're seeing seagrass pop up, as you said, and we have a Chesapeake Bay blueprint now that's guiding those restoration efforts in terms of making sure we reduce our pollutant loads. And anything that we do that lessens our ability to protect local water quality especially is going to end up basically not providing the level of water quality that we want to see, both in the local tributaries, but in the Chesapeake Bay as a whole.
You know, it occurs to me that what Woodrow is talking about here, John Bull, is really emblematic of so many of the issues that we face, because water does not respect geographic boundaries. And so what, as he notes, what you do in one place has an effect elsewhere.
Well, that's certainly true, and we've learned a lot over the last couple of generations here of the interconnectedness with our natural resources. Water quality impacts submerged aquatic vegetation, which impacts crab stocks. These types of relationships are becoming more and more clear, but Chris Moore is absolutely correct that the negative impact on a localized area does have a wider-ranging repercussion. So, and these are things we need to take into consideration very carefully.
And so if you were to give Woodrow a piece of advice, what might that be? Since he's talking about, you know, he is not a resident of the neighboring county, but he's very concerned about what the impact of their changes may be.
Well, all citizens have a right in our democracy to have a say, whether it's a local citizen or a neighboring citizen. I think that good intelligent comments are sought after at all levels of government.
Carol's on the line from Norfolk. Hi, Carol. You're on the air. Carol, you're on the air. Go right ahead.
Hi, this is Carol.
Hi, go right ahead.
I don't know if it's a question or whatever, but okay. I'm 61 years old. I've lived about 40 of those years in the Tidewater area, from Virginia Beach to Norfolk to Newport News.
Okay.
Always lived on the water or close to the water. As children, we would go out crabbing, from Rudy Inlet all the way up to where the Lesner Bridge is.
So what have you noticed over that time?
I've noticed that the crabs, we used to catch crabs that when you pulled them arm to arm, they were bigger than 2 feet. They were the most beautiful blue crabs. We always respected and threw the females back. They were enormous.
Yeah.
And then with commerce, I guess, and pollution, overfishing, not just the local fisher guys, but the massive, fishing, they just wiped them out all in the name of money. And it happens in a lot of areas on the planet, and it's heartbreaking.
Yeah. Carol, I think that's a piece of what all of these initiatives are designed. That's what all of these initiatives are designed to do, essentially, is to return, hopefully, to a time when things were better.
That's right. And to have both, like we talked about earlier, ecologically healthy species, but economically viable fisheries as well. And the caller actually hit on a good point, and it's a concern amongst our commercial fishermen, and John can speak to this as well, I'm sure, that the size of the blue crabs we currently harvest is not big,
right,
and therefore they're not getting top dollar for that. And there is lots of interest in ways that we make our fishery more economically valuable. We don't necessarily have to catch more crabs, but we make the crabs
better
that we
crabs.
Catch better crabs. Exactly,
yeah.
Exactly.
Not
and we've
more,
had
but
a lot.
Better.
That's
yeah.
right. We've actually had lots of discussions about that at the habitat, the Crab Management Committee
Got
at the
it.
MRC.
John Bull, I know that you, that's probably not the first time you've heard something like what Carol has described. What is VMRC doing about that development of a better crab?
Well, it's a multi-pronged approach here, and the first step starts with greater abundance levels of crabs. Before we reach a point here where we can address the quality of crabs, we have to address the abundance. If we don't have enough crabs, we can't have a viable industry, and we don't have the ecological benefits that crabs pose. So we've been focused over the last couple of years on building up crab abundance, and I can say that I'm heartened by the direction that we've been going. The stock is now in decent shape, and that has not been the case. There was a 17-year decline in the abundance of crabs there from the mid-90s all the way up, early 80s, mid-80s all the way up to the late 90s. We are now, through a stock rebuilding program and really careful management, the abundance of the blue crab stock is at the fourth highest level we've seen since 1990.
Wow.
The last 2 years have shown some dramatic improvements in overall abundance. And in fact, the last 2 years, the number of crabs in the bay has increased 86%. That's pretty substantial
yeah, that
improvement.
Is.
We've seen the harvest grow over the last 2 years as well, even while we're rebuilding the crab stock. And in fact, our harvest projections for this year shows that we estimate about 30 million pounds of crabs will be harvested this year, 2016, in Virginia waters. And that's a 37% increase over just last year. So I think things are going on the right track here. We are seeing a lot more crabs. We are seeing a lot better abundance. We're seeing a stabilized economic industry for the crab fishery. But back to Carol's basic point, back in the old days, we can remember crabs plentiful. We can remember them very large, that they were all over the place. But that was before all these changes to the bay happened. Mm. And I tell recreational anglers the same thing. This is not the same Chesapeake Bay that we remember from the 1970s and the 1960s. Millions of more people live in this watershed. There are serious issues with sediment overrun from up north and flows downhill. We have declines in general in submerged aquatic vegetation, which is important habitat for juvenile crabs and juvenile fish. We have seen pollution levels that cause dissolved oxygen and dead zones here that we did not see in the 70s and the 60s and in the early 80s. This is not the same bay as we remember back in our youth.
It's a
going to take a long time to get back to that point, but we're on the right path, I think.
Yeah, interesting way to think about it, that this is not the bay we used to have for all kinds of different reasons. John Bull with us today. He's the head of the Virginia Marine Resources Commission, the commissioner of the Virginia Marine Resources Commission. We're also talking with Chris Moore, who is the senior scientist for the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. Anita's on the line from Moyock. Hi, Anita, you're on the air.
Yeah, my question is, I was just wondering if the Navy is helping out with keeping our bays clean.
Ah, it's a great question.
It is, and I'm always excited to see all the efforts that our armed forces have put forth towards restoring the Chesapeake Bay. They have a team that works on all the regional facilities, and they have done some great work. And in fact, they actually got started in some cases even earlier than our localities
Wow.
did. There was the Chesapeake Bay Blueprint, but even before that, there was an executive order that President Obama issued. And right away, our military facilities got working on that.
That's fantastic.
In addition, as you know, we do Clean the Bay Day here in June of
Yes.
each year. The military tends to be our strongest supporter in terms of volunteers for that event each year. So not only they help with the pollution in terms of nitrogen and phosphorus, but also they provide people power as
yeah,
well to
sure.
help that clean up.
It's a great point, Anita. I do thank you for the call. John Bull, thank you for being with us today from the Virginia Marine Resources Commission. You gave us a really interesting way to think about the future of the bay as it relates to the past of the bay. Thanks very much. John Bull is the commissioner of the Virginia Marine Resources Commission. Chris Moore, I'm always glad to talk with you, and thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And Megan Weir, thank you for joining us as well from Atlantic States Marine Fisheries Commission.
Thank you.
You're welcome. We're at 19 minutes before the hour again. That hearing coming up December 5th at 6 o'clock at the VMRC at 2600 Washington Avenue in Newport News. And you'll also want to know about the Menhaden Matter event. That's coming up the very next day, Tuesday, December 6th, 6:30 to 8:30 at the Slover Library. Admission is free, but they would love to know that you're coming at cbf.org/blueplanet. And we're back in just a moment. Backward 18 minutes before the hour, Fidel Castro, Cuban revolutionary, a turned national leader, governed Cuba for 47 years as prime minister, then as president for another 20, 30, 40 or so, died Friday. And there are 9 days of mourning underway in Havana right now for Fidel Castro. And his death certainly has been rumored for some time. His ill health has been a factor for several years now. His brother essentially running the country. We're glad to have Dr. Anne-Marie Stock with us today, a professor of Hispanic Studies and Film and Media Studies at the College of William and Mary. Dr. Stock, thank you for being with us today.
My pleasure, Kathy.
So I wonder how you describe Fidel. I've had very interesting conversations with people since his death was announced about how they would describe him. Some say he's a strong man. Some say he was a dictator. Some say he was a revolutionary. So he's a very complex individual, it seems.
He certainly is, Kathy. And I think one thing to consider is that people tend to be really polarized in their descriptions of Fidel Castro. In fact, even his name, some call him Castro.
Yeah.
And for those people, he's a tyrant. He's a dictator. He is an individual who separated the Cuban people, causing some Cubans to move into exile and others to remain on the island. For other people, though, and this would tend to be many of the Cubans on the island, He's called Fidel. Mm. They treat him on a first name basis, and he's more of a benevolent father or uncle or brother. In fact, I'm thinking of a film made about him called My Brother Fidel, Mi Hermano Fidel. So for those, you know, for that sector, he's not this tyrant, not this dictator. And so I think we see this binary, we see this duality when Fidel Castro comes to mind. Regardless of what side an individual is on in thinking about Fidel Castro, certainly his death is significant, just as his life was significant. Mm. You know, it's undeniable that he's had a great significance in the lives of Cubans, whether they make their home on the island or elsewhere. He's had a great significance for many in Latin America and others around the world as well.
Yeah. And, you know, I think we sort of saw this played out certainly in the interviews with people on the island and people in Miami most especially. But I think you also saw it play out around the comments of the Canadian Prime Minister, who said he was a remarkable leader, Cuba's longest serving president, and came under tremendous fire for that because of what appeared to be his lack of acknowledgement of Fidel Castro's human rights record.
That's right. I think human rights comes up often, and I think that too is more complex than we sometimes understand it to be. I think absolutely there's no denying human rights violations in Cuba during the past half century. I think, though, it's a very delicate subject because there have been human rights violations that have taken place on Guantanamo base as well. And so I think for Cubans, this is a real source of pain and of hurt that, you know, we continue to make these accusations without taking responsibility for our own activities on what they perceive to be their territory.
And of course, there was this remarkable agreement in 2014 that opened relations between the U.S. and Cuba, and those developments have been sort of happening over the last couple of years. And President-elect Trump has said that unless a better deal can be had, he has no problem scrapping the 2014 agreement. What's your take on that?
Well, I am hoping that he's perhaps speaking hastily. I think the Cuban people have been very eager to move closer to the U.S. For decades. My first trip to Cuba was as a graduate student in 1989, and it surprised me to learn at that point that Cubans were very eager to connect with people in the U.S. They repeatedly would say, look, our governments don't see eye to eye, our governments are at odds, but we, the people, have so much in common with one another, so much to gain by being on better terms. So I'm hoping that President Obama's overtures to Cuba and those overtures that Raul Castro and the Cubans also made back to the U.S., I'm hoping that that momentum can continue. I think given the, you know, whether one looks at the potential for our economic gain or whether one looks at the potential for Cubans to have a much easier time securing goods and you know, consumer items, it would seem hasty to roll that back. I would like to see both sides continue to be in dialogue and continue to think about this moment as being pivotal, perhaps in further cementing our relationship with one another.
We're 12 minutes before the hour talking with Dr. Anne Marie Stock. She has been to Cuba about 60 times over nearly 30 years, so she knows quite a lot about the island, quite a lot about the complexity of its leadership, and quite a lot about U.S.-Cuban relationships and how they have evolved. You know, it strikes me that, and you would have to, and I'm sure you do, acknowledge the pain of families that have been separated as a result of the revolution and the like. And, of course, we have a very vibrant Cuban community in South Florida as a result. And it's interesting to look at this, I think, generationally. That's what really struck me when he died. You talk about older people who still have very vivid memories of what happened and a lot of undeniable pain. Then you look at younger people for whom Fidel was not much of an actual presence, but more of an iconic presence, if that makes sense.
That makes all the sense in the world, Kathy. I think you're just putting your finger on it. I think one's image of Fidel, one's reaction to his death has a great deal to do with one's experience and certainly generation. And so without a doubt, there's a great deal of pain among Cubans who felt compelled to leave their island, who felt they were driven away from their home culture and had to resettle elsewhere. So this is a time of reflection, of pain and loss for them, just as it is a time of reflection and uncertainty for Cubans on the island who are experiencing this moment. Certainly, Cubans who would deem themselves to be the architects of the revolution, those who actively participated in this socio-political upheaval, are experiencing this moment much more poignantly than would their children and grandchildren. Mm. And I think that experience is also being played out in Miami. I think, generations who, elderly people who lived in Cuba, who had that firsthand experience, have experienced much more of an emotionally charged relationship with the island than have those who grew up in the U.S.
We're at 9 minutes before the hour. Some folks at the Chrysler Museum of Art just returned from a big trip to Cuba. I was talking with a couple of them the other day, and it was very interesting because they were saying, you know, they have sort of grown up with an image of Fidel as a revolutionary despot, and it was very striking to them that they acknowledged that there were aspects of the life on the island that they thought were quite good and where there had been some successes. So it's always interesting how travel, can broaden our perspectives and at least make us more aware. Kit's on the line from Norfolk. Hi, Kit. You're on the air.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
You're welcome.
I think that the expert, the professor, has really, chosen very good words to describe this. Complexity really is the word when talking about Cuban and American relations. And I cannot imagine a worse person to be the head of American diplomacy in this era than Donald Trump and Bannon and his cadre. I am so sick of listening to this clown talk about getting better deals. Well, if they're not going to give a better deal, then I'm just going to throw it all away. It doesn't work that way. And I'm also very tired already, he's not even in office, of people excusing and normalizing it, saying, well, I hope that he's just speaking hastily. I hope that when he gets in the office, he'll be different. He's not going to be different. He's proven that over and over again. And rather than placating fears about what he's going to do, we need to be preparing to counter his toxic influence nationally and internationally. He's proven on the campaign that he never apologizes. He doesn't back down. If you can say one thing about him, he's secure in his conviction.
Yeah. Kit, I hear what you're saying, and we're actually developing some programming around this particular issue, around where we are as a country now in terms of having those conversations and how we speak about what's going on, what is different today. And so we are definitely working on some shows around that issue, and I appreciate your call. As it relates specifically to this issue of his statements around Cuba, there has, as you know, Amory Stock, been concern about that. The first tweet had, I think it just said, Fidel Castro is dead. And there was a critique that was not a very nuanced response. And so I wonder, from your perspective, what's at stake when we look at Cuban-U.S. relationships and the changing of the administration?
Well, I want to say I want to thank Kit for calling in, and I think I would agree completely with what he said, that we are not looking to buy a hotel or a casino here with Cuba and therefore negotiating for a better deal. We are looking to move closer to a country that's has close proximity with us, but from whom we've been estranged for a half century. And so this is a very important diplomatic moment. Kathy, I would say that it's vital for us to manage our relationship with Cubans on the island at this time. I think there is a sense that it's not appropriate for any state leader to approach the death of another nation's leader with quips and with rhetoric that can be perceived as a rhetoric of hate. And I think there's also implications beyond Cuba and the U.S. I think the U.S. has been a model for, you know, we like to perceive ourselves as a leader in the world. And I think in order for that to continue, I think our leaders and our national rhetoric has to be one of respect, has to be one of dignity. Cubans very much value respectfulness. They value, they have a term they call solidarity. They very much value sticking together during difficult times. And so I think they're finding it exceedingly hurtful to be, getting from a high level, the president-elect, this rhetoric of hate.
Thank you for the call. I appreciate it, Kit. And we will, tomorrow, in fact, we are talking, we're sort of continuing some conversations in the post-election environment in which we find ourselves. In fact, tomorrow on the broadcast, we're going to be talking about the rise in fake news and what we can all learn from that. Dr. Stock, I wonder, are you planning another trip to Cuba anytime soon?
Yes, I am. I actually have a trip that I scheduled before the death of Fidel Castro. There's an international film festival that takes place in Havana every December, and I routinely go, and so I'm planning to be there in beginning on December 9th for a week, just over a week.
Oh, nice. I know so many people who have been and who are sort of beginning that that transit and that travel back and forth. A lot of Cuban culture is now coming into the States in more significant ways. So it'll be very interesting to see where this goes from here. I want to thank you so much for joining. I want to sign up for your next trip, too. That just sounds completely fun.
I'll save you a spot.
Thank you so much for being with us today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Dr. Anne-Marie Stock is a professor of Hispanic Studies and Film and Media. We were glad to get her today in the conversation because she talks to all the big network shows. She has been more than 60 times, to Cuba over the last 30 years. So she is very, very highly knowledgeable at the College of William and Mary, where she is the library's faculty scholar as well. We're talking about the impact of the death of Fidel Castro. Thanks so very much for being with us today. Again, tomorrow we're going to be talking about the rise in fake news, what we can learn about that, what the steps are that we may be taking moving forward in our own lives. And so we'll talk about that a bit tomorrow. So glad you were with us today. Up next on 89.5, it's Making Contact. And then coming up tonight on WHRO TV 15 at 8, it's Those Celtic Women, They're Home for Christmas. And then at 9:30, Visions of Italy Southern Style. We're going to be soaring above the, and by we, I mean the viewers, are going to be soaring above the landscape of Southern Italy. So that's coming up tonight at 9 on WHRO TV 15. Thanks so very much for being with us today, and we will see you right back here tomorrow.